Welcome to the third edition of Wine and Dine with Amy Irvine. Today we'll be talking to Brian Hanks. Brian Hanks is a colleague of mine in the financial planning industry. He is a unique individual in that he has a clear vision of working with dentists as he continues to grow his practice. He's also a unique individual because he has four children, as mentioned in the podcast. That to me just blows my mind. I think you'll enjoy learning about Brian's direction, how he became a financial advisor, which was not anything like the path that I took. We hope you enjoy this episode with Brian Hanks, and we also hope you enjoy drinking a glass of Lemberger, also by Lakewood. As you recall, we recommended them last month, but we really enjoy a good glass of Lemberger, and they make one of the best in the Finger Lakes. So we hope you look that up. We hope you enjoy it as much as we always do. And we hope that you have a wonderful November.
You are listening to Wine and Dime, a podcast that combines two passions, wine and personal finance. Hosted by Amy Irvine, certified financial planner and owner of Irvine Wealth Planning Strategies, located in Corning, New York. And now, here's your host, Amy Irvine.
Well, good afternoon, Brian. How are you today?
Thank you. I am great, Amy. It is a pleasure to be here.
Well, to all of those listeners, I'd like to introduce you to one of my mastermind group members, Brian Hanks. Brian actually specializes in working with dentists, and he has the one most unique practice that I've actually seen in that he actually knows exactly what his market is. So, Brian, if you wouldn't mind, would you take a moment to just introduce yourself real quick and give us an idea of why you started specializing in working with dentists?
Sure thing, Amy. I'm happy to do that. I am a Salt Lake City-based financial advisor. I do just work with dentists, and they tend to be younger. I turned, 2017, I turned 37 this year, and that's about the median age of folks I work with. They are either buying or have recently bought their first dental practice, or they're a few years out from owning. And like anyone that age, they have a lot of financial issues. They are dealing with, lots of competing priorities in terms of their own student debt. And a lot of them have kids, and they're thinking about college education and budgeting and retirement and everything else. And then you throw layer on top of that a business, which is their dental practice, and their life becomes complex. And that's the intersection that I like to get in and help with. For background, I have an undergraduate degree from Brigham Young University in just south of where I am now. I've lived in 10 cities in the last 12 years, my wife and I. One of them was Ann Arbor, Michigan, where I got my MBA. And so how I landed in this niche, is kind of a funny story. I was working in supply chain management. I was in Mexico, in Juarez, Mexico, kind of pre-cartel killings. Okay. So safe at the time.
I have to interrupt for a quick second. So supply chain demand.
Supply chain management. I got a degree in business, but supply chain management is the movement of goods in a business. So how do you think Walmart or Amazon? How in the world can Amazon ship you 14 disparate items in under 2 days? That's supply chain management.
So, okay, this is like a night and day sort of switch.
You're in Mexico. My father-in-law is a dentist, right? So I'm married, got married my last semester of college of undergrad, and married to a gal whose father-in-law is, or whose father is a dentist. And he has a financial advisor who puts on a seminar for kids of clients. Says, hey, $500 or something, come to Dallas, we'll do a 2-day seminar for your kids. So my wife and I drive from El Paso to Dallas, and I'm sitting in this room, Amy, watching people like you give presentations on financial planning topics. I'm like, this is so cool. I would love that job. That looks so much more interesting than the factories that I'm in making. At the time, I was making Avery labels, the Avery company. So I read 30 books on financial planning, investments, advisory, and started managing friends and family and parents' money, and that's kind of how I got started.
That's amazing. What I didn't know about your story is that you lived in 10 different cities. So you know how to pack well. Anybody wants some lessons, you can definitely provide them. So when you read all, you said 30-some books or so, did you then decide, okay, I think this is truly a career for me. I think I'm going to go back to college, or what was your next step at that point in time?
That's a good question. My wife was actually the catalyst. She looked at the bookshelf and said, why are you doing this over here when clearly you enjoy that? And, you know, for me, it was a bumpy road. And Amy, I'm going to put the blame on the industry, although I'm sure I could take some of the blame myself. But hey, I'm human, so let's blame somebody else. Remember that TV commercial? Let's blame. So I did a pre-MBA internship with a firm in Dallas, an RIA in Dallas that worked with Dennis. So that's kind of how I got started in the niche. Mm-hmm. But I was looking around, and this is as the financial crisis is going on. I'm an intern, and I'm watching these financial advisors make exactly the wrong moves with their clients' money. Couldn't have been worse, right? October 2008 or 9 and 8. Let's sell, and let's sell 25%. And then let's wait till March and sell another 25%. So you're 50% in cash at the bottom of the market. Mm-hmm. And just violating every principle that, you know, anybody that studied finance, maybe not psychology, but finance knows. So I did that. Then I got into business school and I thought, well, obviously this little firm doesn't know how to do it. I'm going to go work for Goldman Sachs. So I did an internship with Goldman Sachs in their private wealth management division. Went to New York, was on Wall Street, did the training, came out to Chicago, worked in their office. And I watched highly paid, very intelligent and very eloquent salespeople sell products to clients that didn't need them. Hmm. And I thought, this is ridiculous. If this is what the industry is, I don't want any part of it. And so I actually, after business school, I went to work in consumer banking for Bank of America. I didn't even go into advisory. I was in bank branches. I was managing employees. I had nothing to do with investments, personal finance, financial planning. And I really missed it. But I did land here. I'm glad I did. It was a little bit of a journey, Amy. But, I don't blame consumers that are confused today as to who to trust and why, because frankly, there are a lot of bad actors out there.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that's one of our biggest frustrations within our mastermind group when we sometimes are talking about situations that we've tried to help clients with. We're trying to rescue them from something that was done to them and not for them. And it's very frustrating. Yeah. Now, a lot of people don't know this about our group, but we all actually started within the same network around the same time. And we've gotten to know each other pretty well over the last, I would say, year and a half. And one thing that I love particularly about Brian and his family is that they are really good at writing. And Brian's wife is really good at editing. So tell us about the book that you wrote.
Yeah, I, speaking of stumbling into careers, one of the roles that I took on at my prior firm was to help dentists who were buying out retiring doctors or other dentists, young dentists buying out old dentists and purchasing their practice. And I developed a system and a set of steps and tools to walk these dentists through the process. And I started looking around. It's so funny, Amy, and this is right the quintessential story. I looked on Amazon, I Googled, I looked for blog posts, and I found this, there was a little bit of advice here and there, but no one source to put it all together. And arrogantly thought, well, how hard could it be? I'll just write a quick book. I'd heard about through the XY Planning Network. I've heard of people like Mary Beth Storjohn that, write their own book and publish it through Amazon's self-publishing platform. that can't be that difficult. And you're kind to say that I'm a good writer. I don't know that I am. It was a first attempt at anything like a book, but I tried to make it readable for the user. And 3 to 4 months after I thought I would have finished the book, I actually did finish and got it published. And it's out there. And Amy, it's so funny. I just looked yesterday and it grew. I have done no advertising. There's nothing out there. If you actually Google how to buy a dental practice, which is the title of the book, you see blog posts from brokers, and the Amazon link doesn't even come up. So you have to be in Amazon and you have to look for how to buy a dental practice. And I think the first 3 months I sold 5 to 10 copies, somewhere there. But last month I sold 26. And then if you count the Kindle copies, it's up to 40 or something now. So
yeah, and
hopefully word is spreading.
And I think one of the unique things about your approach is that if you Google how to sell a practice, there's lots of availability in that market, but there's nothing on how to buy it. And this will be probably the second or maybe even the first biggest investment that most dentists would make, wouldn't you say?
Oh, definitely. I mean, it's right up there next to who do you marry? How many kids do you have? Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yep. I would think the biggest.
And then financially, I would think, you know, a lot of them come out of college with pretty significant student loans, right? And then they have maybe a mortgage that goes along with those student loans. And then like anything else, you know, some consumer debt along with that. Right. And then you add on top of that, that you're looking to add in purchasing a practice. You could look at easily being in debt over $1 million when you add all those things together.
That's right. Most of them are. The average dental student loan, so this is just general dentists, no specialty, but they have $273,000.
and their mortgage is like $300,000.
And so I address that right up front. The first chapter in the book says, you know, what should I even buy a dental practice? I've got all these student loans. What should I do? And I run them through an analysis to talk about that. But you're right. It's a big deal.
And so then when you think about, first of all, I know one of the chapters in the books talks about the pros and cons, not just from a standpoint of buying the practice, but the pros and cons of going from being a dentist to running a practice. They are two very different skill sets that are required, right? And it's no different than you and I running our practice. There's the business and then there is the actual financial planning when working with the clients. And they are two very separate entities. And sometimes they pull you in the middle or pull you apart a little bit, you know, which hat am I wearing? And that's true for dentists as well. What's their passion? What do they actually want to own a business or do they want to practice dentistry?
We all wear different hats. I mean, I think about my clients, some of your clients, I'm sure, feel this way. Whether you're an employee or a business owner, mm-hmm. you have a father, son, daughter, you know, you have various hats that you wear at different times.
Yeah.
Some that you wear better than others. And it's human nature to try to, at least I think most people think they're amazing at all of them. But I think it's healthy to acknowledge that you maybe don't know everything and you could be better at one role than another, and asking for help is appropriate.
That's such a key statement, asking for help. That's so challenging sometimes. And, you know, I just read an article just the other day and it talked about, is achieving a balanced life possible? And one of the quotes that I loved in that is they said, I think you have to focus on achieving success and being in the moment. So, you know, what's balanced mean? So if I'm at work, I need to be 100% at work. And if I'm at home, I need to be 100% at home, which is very challenging when you're running your own business. Or if you're like me, type A personality, you just don't shut down. But it is something that I think anybody who's thinking about buying any kind of practice, whether it's dentistry, financial planning, or, you know, a physician, or anybody needs to be thinking about, is that something that, you know, their understanding is going to flesh out. And one of the questions that I have for you, because you've been doing this to be able to see some succession plans put in place, What do you see the situations that most likely work? How do people arrange it in a way that it's not going to blow up in their face?
Yeah, you know, this will sound like a self-serving comment, but it's really not. The number one thing that I see contribute to a successful transition is that the seller has sat down with their accountant / financial advisor, and they are actually ready to walk away from their career or their practice. In my case, they would be a dentist, right? Selling their practice. And what happens a lot of times is these dentists say, oh my gosh, I'm so tired. I'm 64 years old. I want to be done with this. And nobody wants to see me because I do drilling and filling, and I'm just ready. Okay, I'm going to sell. And they go and they sell and they see how much they can sell for. And then they go sit down with an advisor who says, yeah, this money's only going to last you for the next 15 years. And then they reverse course. So the number one thing I see is, you know, is the seller actually prepared? Beyond that, though, I mean, I think this would be more applicable beyond dentistry. It would be similar philosophies. Mm. And that would be how you treat patients and staff. Mm-hmm. What is the type of patient you like to you know, because in dentistry, you can have cash-only payments, you have insurance patients, you have Medicaid patients, you know, different practices serve different clientele, just like financial advisors serve different niches. And, you know, aligning not only the patients, but the philosophy of how you're going to run your business. And, you know, do you have kind, nice front desk people greeting those patients? Do you have more aggressive sales type people in your office? You know, those are the elements that I see work towards a successful transition. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think from a standpoint of, you know, a company, well, even going back to the comment you made about somebody saying to the dentist that's selling, well, you know, this money's only going to last you 15 years. It's also, which can be very scary when they've spent their entire life in their, you know, in their 60s, like 15 years isn't enough. But the other side of it is, are they actually mentally ready?
Yes.
You know, that's where I've seen things go awry a little bit in my own experience, not just in dental practices, but in lots of succession plans in general. And, you know, what is the, because we talked a little bit about a small amount about business structure, but what do you see it as a better, best business structure for dental practices, and why?
Yeah, it's almost universal that the best advice, and this is state specific. California is kind of weird. There are a couple of East Coast states that are weird, but LLC, go to your state, file an LLC, and then elect with the IRS to be taxed as an S corporation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That gives you the best of both worlds. You get the liability protection of the LLC with the tax benefits of the S corp. Mm-hmm. And so that almost universally is the best option. Again, talk to your lawyer, make a decision based on a guy on a podcast, but that's pretty standard.
That's what you've seen be successful. And can you take just a moment, really high level, and explain to people, because I think this is super important, what that S corp election is beneficial for?
Okay. Yeah. In very simple terms, there are a lot of subtleties here, but in very simple terms, it allows you to take a portion of the income from your business tax-free. Mm-hmm. I like to use an analogy of a castle, right? If the business is a castle, you're on the outside. You know, you want to have money at home to buy groceries and go on vacation and everything else, but all the money is inside the castle. There are only two ways to get money out of the castle. You can come through the front door, right? Lower the drawbridge and have the coach bring out sacks of money. That's payroll, where you have money running through payroll. You're getting taxed. Payroll taxes are, you know, and income taxes, everything else. The other way is to toss bags of money over the wall. And that's an owner draw, right? It's just literally transferring money from your business checking to your personal checking. And there are some rules, and your accountant will fill you in on, you know, how much you can do in various forms. But, you know, that's in a nutshell why an S corp is mine. There are other cool benefits to an S corp as well, but that's the main reason.
Yeah, and as Brian said, you know, you'll want to talk to your attorney and CPA just to kind of get all the details. But I know, you know, it's sort of the way that I've explained it a little bit is it's sort of like thinking about you know, getting a little dividend that doesn't have to be run through through those front doors like you were talking about. So it's something to definitely investigate for any business structure, but particularly for dental practices or practices where income could be significantly higher. And, you know, when kind of going back to that whole succession plan idea, but what are some of the aspects of people both building the business? So, you know, maybe not electing an S corp or not knowing that they need to have an LLC. And then at the time of succession, you know, where could that go wrong if they don't have some good advice? Because, you know, sometimes I'll hear, well, I didn't want to pay for, you know, legal advice or something.
Yeah, penny wise, pound foolish. You will get, and it's almost always the seller. The buyer is almost never affected by this, but the seller, if they didn't get good advice up front, and you know they structured the business wrong, they're just going to get nailed in taxes.
Yeah, that's
when they
a
sell.
Big one. Yeah, yeah, huge, right?
Yeah, it's bad, and you're thinking, gosh, well, I'm handing you this gigantic check and it's just too bad that you don't get to keep more of it, but sorry.
Yeah, and
I'm not going to hand you a bigger check just because you didn't do what you should have done up front.
And depending on the state they're in, it could be as much as 40% total. I mean, between federal and state income taxes, they really could lose a fair portion of that sale. And that's, you know, that's not the expectation. Oh, you know, I have this practice that's worth X and actually ends up being worth 60% of X. So it's pretty painful. So let's kind of switch gears just a little bit and talk about your upbringing a little bit, because I always think this is pretty interesting for people to know about our backgrounds and different people's backgrounds. But as a kid, were you ever included in on money conversations?
You know, I've thought a little bit sometimes. The main message that I got, remember, as a kid was that there just wasn't very much of it. My dad was an engineer. My mom taught piano. Very hardworking, excellent people, fantastic parents. I mean, we really couldn't have asked for a better upbringing. We never lacked for anything. But money was a scarce resource. And the message that I received as a kid was that, you know, there just wasn't very much of it. Mm-hmm. And so those are the messages I received. How I reacted to that was I went and got a paper route. You know, what? I can't go buy a Ken Griffey Jr. hat. Well, at 11 years old, I went to the Seattle Times and said, you know, I want to be a paper boy. And that's how I kind of took the bull by the horns. And I've learned little lessons along the way. But, you know, growing up, that's what I remember was there just isn't very much of it.
And so there wasn't really a conversation around it, but you understood it. You had enough of a background to say, well, mom and dad said, I don't have the money for that hat. So what am I going to do about that? And here's my options. And I'm assuming that that's kind of how your kids are sort of figuring out things a little bit as well.
Yeah. You know, on Sunday, so what are we, Tuesday recording this? So 2 days ago, and Amy, you'll chuckle because you won one also, but I won an iPad at the Expert Pan conference. And I let my two oldest, ages 10 and 8, borrow it to take some videos, and they took it outside and they cracked the screen. And it's not so bad that it's unusable, but I'm, you know, my wife and I sat down and they're going to have to pay for the screen repair. And, you know, an 8-year-old has to come up with, so it's $120 between the two of them, $60 each. And it's going to be a painful lesson. Now, it's ironic. Now we have to think of ways for them to earn money. But they're going to put in some work. And, you know, I think back, Amy, to, you know, this is a little later on in life. I did a 2-year mission in Russia for my church. And so I was gone. And in the summer between senior year of high school and that mission, I earned a few thousand bucks doing construction work. So I had $2,000 left over that was just going to sit in a checking account. And I knew enough to know that that was a bad thing. But I was going to be gone and I wasn't going to be able to manage the money or use the money. And so I remember handing my dad a check for $2,000 at age 19 and saying, hey, Dad, will you invest this in the stock market for me? And I'll be back in 2 years. Get it. And he did. And he said, no problem. You've got it taken care of for you. Oh, thanks, Dad. This is great. And, you know, interestingly enough, what he did, and this is 1999, He invested it all in Cisco, ticker symbol CSCO, which was a wise move for the first 8 months of that money. And then it wasn't a wise move. And I came back and my $2,000 was worth $1,600, mm-hmm. which now that I look back is actually probably better than it could have been. And I remember thinking, Dad, you didn't do this right. Don't you know how this works? And, you know, and it's funny because I have that conversation with 60-year-old professionals who are amazing in every other aspect of their life, and they just don't understand some of the basics around finance, and they haven't mm-hmm. learned that particular lesson yet.
Yeah, you know that I work with a lot of people that have a large chunk of their assets with Corning Incorporated, and you know, I'll have the conversation with them about the risks, and you know, they'll say to me, but it's going to go up a little bit more. I just want to wait. It's just going to go up a little bit more. And I'll say, but I can't guarantee you that it's going to go up a little bit more. You know, I can't guarantee anything is going to, but can't we just be not all of our eggs in one basket? Yeah, I know. And these are smart people. These are very smart people.
They really, exactly. Exactly. It's not intuitive, but a little bit of education goes a long way. Sometimes it's the pool of hard knocks.
Yeah, sometimes it is. So that's an interesting conversation, or an interesting event that happened in your life. Would you say that? Would you say that that was a good education because you were ultimately able to see it come back, or do you feel that that was an education that was, you know, you wish you had avoided?
No. So glad that I had that lesson. It was the cheapest tuition that I've ever had. $400. It was amazing, Amy. The money was in Scottrade, mm-hmm. The brokerage that was just bought by TD Ameritrade. Mm-hmm. And I got the username and password, and I spent months just digging in, trying to figure out how to buy and sell. What does it mean when they go up and down? What makes it go up and down? And it was just fascinating to me. And I've been fascinated ever since. And I'm so glad I had that lesson. And I would recommend it to any parent mm-hmm. of a teenager, or even a young 12, 13-year-old kid. If they're old enough to recognize brands around them, right? I want Nike shoes. I need an Under Armour sweatshirt, whatever. You know, I'm showing my sports bias, but, you know, if they're old enough to recognize brands, they're old enough to own a share or three or five of some stock and to learn some of these lessons. And it's, you have to be careful. You don't teach them speculation, but if you can teach them some of the basics of how markets work and, you know, stocks versus bonds and why they go up and down. I mean, how much better would it have been to learn that a 40% dip in the stock market isn't the end of the world at age 18 than at age 48 right. or 58 or 68?
Right. I think I shared this story with you. So I apologize if I'm repeating myself, but my husband and I decided with all of our nieces and nephews that we would not give major Christmas or birthday gifts. Instead, we would put money into their 529 accounts. And then when they got to the double digit ages, so 10 years old, we would start having them pick a particular stock. And so when my first nephew turned 10, we sat down with him and said, you know, would you like to own a company? And if so, what company would you like to own? And he picked Minecraft. He was huge and still is huge into Minecraft. So we did some research and said, well, Microsoft actually owns Minecraft. So we're going to buy this company named Microsoft. So he went around telling everybody that he owned Microsoft.
<That's so awesome>.
And when his 11th birthday came around, he wanted more Microsoft because he was still really big into it. So when his 12th birthday rolled around, I said, so do you want more Microsoft? He said, no, I think I should have something else. And then he chose Activision. And then last year he said, you know, I think I want Marvel Studios. So of course we did some research and said, well, you can't buy Marvel Studios, but Disney, yeah. So we purchased Disney. And so now, you know, at 13 years old, he has three different stocks and cool. You know, he's very proud that he owns these three different stocks. And if I ask him about it, he can usually tell me something about those three companies. And then when my second...
Yes. watching the ticker go up and down, like, you know, once a week or something? Is he looking at the share price?
He is. And I'll ask him about it every once in a while, you know, to say, well, how is so, you know, one of the companies, I'll say, how are they doing? And he'll tell me, you know, he'll tell me if they're up or if they're down or if the company's doing something he agrees or doesn't agree with. It's hysterical. I mean, I feel like I'm having this conversation with, you know, an adult, and he's 13. So it's pretty amazing to me what that, you know, lesson, like you were talking about, is what it can do. And hopefully, you know, hopefully they will continue to feel that this was a good gift to them over the course of their life. So what would you say was the biggest financial concern for yourself at this age of your life? You said that you're 37. You know, what concerns do you have, not only for you, but, you know, maybe in particular your age group?
Yeah, it's, I would say, the exact same concerns as the clients that I'm working with. Mm-hmm. How do I manage the competing priorities, and where do I rank the priorities, right? Retirement savings, how do you not be too cheap to avoid enjoying the day-to-day, but not so lavish that you're, you know, not saving as much as you should. And then I still have a few student loans left that are at a low interest rate, but it'd be nice to knock those out. But also, you know, kids' college. And so really it's just managing the different balls, juggling them, and making sure that they're prioritized appropriately. Mm-hmm.
And we've talked a little bit about your kids, but, you know, what are the biggest financial concerns that you have for them?
Yeah, I've thought a little bit about this, and my biggest concern for my kids is the shifting economy, mm-hmm. and making sure that they have the tools to provide for themselves. Mm-hmm. And those tools aren't coding, or, you know, you need to be a really good typist or something like that. It's interpersonal skills, critical thinking, you know, presenting yourself well to other people. They're kind of more life skills. Mm-hmm. And, you know, are they going to have those, or are they just going to get run over by an increasingly competitive economy? You know, the days of 40 years in a company are gone. Mm. And the average millennial spends, you know, 2 to 3 years in a company. And I can't imagine that trend is going to reverse. Mm. And so my biggest financial concern for them is that they have the education and the life skills to be able to manage that.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I'll say that, you know, it's funny because I didn't realize that it was like about 2 years for the millennial group, but for the X generation, which is my generation, it was about 5 to 6. And if you look at my career, that's about the longevity of each spot that I've stayed at. It's like we just get to a point where, okay, well, enough. I guess I need to, you know, find my next step. And it's not usually within that same organization. Yeah. Now, you said to me earlier that the best lesson you ever got was a $400 tuition on Cisco. But what is the best financial advice you've ever received?
Ooh, best financial advice for me came from my dad. And he said that you'll never struggle for work if you can keep a promise, especially a promise to a customer.
Wow.
And, you know, if you think about contractors, or, you know, just even going to fix your car, setting expectations appropriately and then meeting those expectations puts you ahead of 90% of people out there, if not more. And so for me, that was the best advice.
I like your dad. I like that advice. Yeah. And do you feel that there's ever been a piece that is so bad, you're like, please don't ever make this decision, you know, especially on the financial side? So the worst financial advice you've ever received?
Oh, let me think. Yeah. You know, I got some advice to go get the most prestigious degree possible. So I had a personal goal to get into a top 10 MBA program, and the tuition matched that designation. And it really was a great education, Amy. I have no complaints about the school itself, but now, sitting where I am, paying back the student loans, looking at some of the other options that I could have done for my graduate degree and how much they would have cost, and now looking at the budget, I would say the worst advice that I got was, oh, go get the best schooling you can and don't even worry about the price. I would say, worry about the price. Yeah. And the answer may still be, go to Harvard, Stanford, wherever, and pay that tuition because the earning potential is there, but at least think about it.
Yeah, I am so glad that you actually brought that up, because it's amazing how many people approach it that way. And it is financially, do you really want your children to, do you really want to put that kind of burden on your children? I mean, not that you would, but you know, people aren't thinking in those terms. So whether it's a guidance counselor, whether it's a coach, or whether it's a parent saying, just go get the best financial education, I believe strongly in getting the best financial education, but also, you know, consider the price tag and where you're getting that education is so important.
100%.
Yeah. One of the questions that I love to get feedback on from other people is, if money wasn't a barrier, what changes would you make in your life?
Oh, I got a funny one to start with. I would hire a personal chef or a nutritionist to like cook all my meals. Sleeping and eating, like if I could do without sleep and eat food and everything, I totally would. And the amount of mental energy and time you spend on shopping and dishes and cooking the food and everything, I would just love to not worry about that.
So, yeah.
So that would be.
You haven't figured out a way to get that in the budget yet, huh?
No, my wife is amazing. She cooks a ton of meals, and I don't do as much work as I probably should around the kitchen and the house, but even that little bit that I do, I'd love to get rid of.
That's funny. I have to quiz her on that sometime. And then what do you feel is your biggest accomplishment, either financially and or personally?
Ooh, biggest accomplishment. Gosh. I just feel like the best ones are yet to come. But let me think. In the past, you know, having 4 well-adjusted kids who can look you in the eye and shake your hand, I think is an accomplishment. I'm proud of that. And I can't take 100% credit for that. I can take a little bit of the credit, and I'm happy that they're around, and we have a good family situation.
It's funny that you say that, because I was gonna actually ask you to, because we've talked about your kids a little bit, to mention how many you have. Because whenever I see pictures of them, they're all always. You know, they seem like they love each other a lot, but I'm sure that there's times where, and it feels like you have 4 children working against you and themselves.
Yeah, 4 kids. It feels like 47 sometimes, but 4. Yeah. And I grew up in a family of 4. My wife had 3. We both grew up in bigger families and really like it. But yes, there are times when we think, oh my gosh, what have we done?
Kudos to you and to anybody that has children. I like to borrow them, as I say, and then give them back.
Oh, no, I wouldn't mind that. In fact, I have some good financial advice you gave me, Amy, if you don't mind.
No.
You'd be welcome to give my kids financial advice anytime. You would think this would be like, when somebody asks the question, what's the best financial advice you ever gave? You think of like a wall quote, right? What can I put on the wall? Or these amazing words of wisdom. And I think for me, Amy, your encouragement and calm demeanor when talking about things that are money related, whether it's business or, you know, a financial decision, those mean more than any specific words themselves. So it's as much how you've said what you said than the actual words themselves.
Well, thank you. I'm glad that can be passed on. It's important to me that the next generation start talking about it too. And by next generation, I mean like your 4 kids. but in a respectful and understanding demeanor and way. And because, you know, I think I read a statistic the other day that said 70% of divorces occur because of financial infidelity. You know, so we need to have those conversations early. We need to have, you know, recognition of how important it is to talk about money. And we need to understand that it needs to be included in conversations, and rationally included in conversations, I should say.
Yeah.
It's a big, you know, money is a big topic, and yet it's taboo for whatever reason. So hopefully that changes in the next generation. I'm a huge advocate of including it in the schools especially in junior and senior years, and really giving some life skills to all kids that are graduating, because, you know, it's not taught in college, it's not taught in every school, and so I think it's super important to have it at an early age, and again, it's that rationalness around it, so that it doesn't seem this like this negative thing. You know, if you always hear your parents fighting about money, you think of it as a negative situation, right? So, yeah. So I have just a couple of final questions, and you know, they're just sort of off the cuff, no right or wrong answer, but I always like to ask people what their definition of success is.
The number of people you help.
That's wonderful. And what feeds your soul?
One-on-one conversations with people I know, like, and trust. Mm-hmm. And if I can have that outdoors, even better.
Ah, add that outdoor element, hence the relocation to an area where there's lots of outdoor options.
It's almost too much, Amy. I go mountain biking less than I do. I should probably work harder.
I think there's a balance. And in closing, would you give any particular advice to listeners about finance that we haven't talked about?
Don't be afraid of your mistakes. Your mistakes are don't be afraid of the ones you have made or the ones that you will make, because you will make more. Mm-hmm. Don't be afraid of them. They will teach you more valuable lessons than any success ever will. And if you can work with somebody that you trust, whether it's a financial advisor you pay or it's just somebody that you know understands money and how it works, and you're able to talk openly about those mistakes or some of the fear you have around making mistakes, those, I think, will lead you down the path toward success so much faster than just being gun shy and afraid to do anything. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. I just read a book called Give and Take by Adam Grant. I don't know if you've ever read that or not, but one of the things that he mentions in there is, you know, authentic people will admit when they've made a mistake and shift gears.
Yeah.
And we all do it. So why don't we share those experiences so we can maybe, you know, help somebody else that is almost going to do it, right?
Right.
So it goes along with your comment around money, around hiring, around anything that we do with charitable organizations or anything like that, is sometimes we just have to pivot quickly when we fail, right? And just change the structure or direction that they're headed down, and just say, oh, you know, we tried, because it happens. And
that's right.
I think fear can be a real evil feeling or prohibitor or inhibitor in our lives. If we are always afraid of, you know, doing anything, then we're going to miss out on some really cool things.
If I could put in a good book recommendation, Dale Carnegie, who wrote How to Win Friends and Influence People, wrote another book called How to Stop Worrying and Start Living. Mm-hmm. And it's cut from the same cloth, if a listener's ever read How to Win Friends and Influence People. But it was excellent for that. Mm-hmm. You know, what are some tools you could use to quit worrying and get rid of some of that fear? I really enjoyed it. It really spoke to me.
Yeah, that's an excellent recommendation. Thank you for making that. I'll add that to my want to read list. I love, and worrying is a real problem for me sometimes. I don't always worry about the things that I can, well, most of the time, they're things I can't control. And so what are the techniques that you can implement in your life that can eliminate that fear and worry that you can't control? So no, I'll definitely add that one to my book to be read list.
Good. Well, yeah.
Brian, thank you so much for joining us today. And I really appreciate you opening up and sharing all the information that you did with us. And I'm going to put some information about your company in the show notes. So if anybody is interested on how to get a hold of Brian, you can go to the show notes and get that information. And Brian, if you wouldn't mind, if you just want to throw out the best way for people to contact you, is it email?
email is best for me, and it's easy to remember. It's my first name, so Brian with an I, at brianhanks.com.
All right. We'll put some information about your company in the show notes as well as your contact information. Thanks again for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Amy. It was a pleasure to be here.
And that will about do it for this week's episode of Wine and Dime. You can visit Amy on the web at irvineadvise.com. Or you can follow her on Twitter at Amy Irvine Advise, or on her Facebook page, Irvine Wealth Planning Strategies. If you have any questions, comments, or topics that you would like to hear about, feel free to contact us through Twitter or Facebook, and we will do our best to answer your questions. We would love to hear from you. And thank you for listening.